Hello, this is Jonathan Marks via PCJ Online, just about to push the button on another programme from the media network Vintage Radio Archives.
Broadcasting from Hilversum, the Netherlands, this is the son of PCJJ. Invitation to relive the past in Media Network's Crystal Clear, introduced by Jonathan Marks.
Hello, and the station is Radio Netherlands, in case you're wondering. And following successful programmes on Vintage Radio a little while back, we've had quite a lot of letters on the subject. So, with spring in the air, time to trek back to London to start with, and the Vintage Wireless Museum there. Its director is Gerald Wells. Pick up any electronics magazine today, and in the small advertisements you'll find entrepreneurs offering one gadget or another to improve reception, an aerial tuning unit, or a notch filter for whistles, for example. Were they around in the 1920s and 30s, when people had much simpler radio sets?
Oh, most definitely. There are several different ways, mostly to do with the aerial, naturally. One, of course, was, if you're in a high-interference area, was to have your aerial rigged up in a position of no interference, and then a transformer and a screened lead coming into the house and another transformer stepping signal up again to your set so you could get away from trams and other source of interference. And of course, the classic one was the wave trap, or as they call it now, a notch filter. This usually stood in a nice polished ebonite, wood, or Bakelite box on top of your set with a knob and a dial 0 to 100 and consisted of a variable condenser and a coil with a configuration of plugs and sockets on the back so you could connect them in series or parallel across or in series with aerial circuit. This was necessary because before the Lucerne Plan and the Geneva Convention, a lot of the different stations had very high power, especially the German Deutschlandsenders. Even I think Radio Paris was fairly powerful and could give adjacent channel interference to some of our domestic stations. Some sort of a filter was very necessary to get rid of the other ones, to get them out of the way.
And it does work?
Oh, it worked very efficiently, and does even today. It was very useful during a war when the London calling Europe, not only called Europe, but it also jolly nigh blotted out our forces programme in this country as well. It was rather handy to be able to tune that out.
What's the most difficult receiver that you've ever had to repair? Because you must have gone through thousands of circuit diagrams.
Well, I'd certainly say it was back to Philips's again. Brilliant firm over they are. They did bring out the V7U and V5 series of sets. It was their answer to the Philco People set. And it came out at something like 6.5, 7 guineas in 1936 and was built without a chassis. It was a Bakelite box with grooves and slots in, and all the parts were stuck into the box with pitch, wax, or anything else they could find, and just one or two self-tapping screws. The set was made up on some sort of a jig, which must have been about 4.5 feet long, and it was gradually wound round the inside of a cabinet and glued into place. The most difficult part of repairing the set, of course, was the drive cord. The set looked like a theatre stage with a proscenium arch and a stage, and the pointer went backwards and forwards across the stage, as it were. The stringing for that is quite alarming. Only Philips's could have devised it. And that had to be put in before the rest of the set was made. Nazet was the first thing to break. Being Philips, the rest of the set carried on for donkey's years, but a string very quickly broke. So to replace that string meant you had to use a pair of Spencer Wells forceps, a thing called a snicket, which was a bit of twisted wire with a hook on the end, and various closed pegs, crocodile clips, anything else to hold the thing into place while you did it. Or you had to take all 4.5 feet of it out of its box, lay it along a long table, put the drive cord in, then reassemble it, and hope you got the stations lining up in the right place and got it right way round. When you've done that, you've got a set which will work for another 50 years without any trouble.
You said that was in answer to Philco's People set. That was brought out for what reason?
Philco People set, I always reckon that was brought out just in time for the Spanish Revolution. It coincided with that. People set sold for 6.5 guineas and was brought out in answer to a challenge put out by the government. Because at that time you couldn't get anything decent under 12 guineas, and the gauntlet was thrown out for radio trade. Philco were the first people to pick it up and bought this set out. At that time, the Spanish Revolution was going very nicely. Lots of talk about free people and fascism and communism and everything else. So naturally, as there was people's housings, people's cars, not much talk about folk, always people. So they bought out the People's Radio. And people bought it because they thought they were supporting the Labour Party or the International Brigade or something else. Sold like hotcakes. They were a beehive-shaped set, very simple circuit, using a multiple valve, there again, to get over our dreadful valve holder tax, two or three American valves, which came into this country for peanuts, a well-designed circuit, a cadmium-plated chassis, a nice fat mains transformer, and it was a superhead. And it could work on a few yards of wire and pick up all the local stations, and still does.
Just as the current trend in radio seems to be small and portable is beautiful, so back in the 1920s, people didn't want others to see their set at all.
In order to get the radio accepted in the living room, it had to change shape. It did no good having it looking like something just come out of a physics lab. So we started disguising radios in various forms, building them into chiffoniers, bureaus, cabinets of all types. And as the speaker was always separate, speakers took on strange forms, like this fellow here, which was the all-familiar funeral casket that you used to have in homes. More morbid in those days. This thing is a little box about the size of a small urn. Looks as if it had a lid on it, but it hasn't. It's actually on feet. It's got all kinds of interesting carvings over it. And it has a little re-entrant horn speaker built underneath it, so the music comes out from underneath. And that could sit on the sideboard, with wires hidden, and look quite inoffensive. The other way, of course, was the Chinese scribe, with his little bald feet and his little carved wooden plaque, and the sound would come out from underneath that.
Didn't it sound very bassy as a result?
It sounded like a wasp in a bottle sort of a sound, but it was a loudspeaker and it was intelligible speech. The music, I think, would have been fairly dreadful.
And who made these?
They were made by a firm called Andia. They did a whole range of them. There was a Spanish lady where the sound came out from under her skirts. There was a pelican with the music coming out of its beak. There was various forms of light shades where music came out from the same place as the light came out of.
And what did you do with the radio then?
Well, that usually looked either like a bureau or was built into a chiffonier, or like the Metropolitan Vicar set upstairs, it looked like a commode. But it wasn't till 1930 that somebody had a bright idea of putting the speaker in the same box as the radio.
So to an upstairs room named after Paul Getty, an important benefactor to the Vintage Wireless Museum. He's genuinely interested in the subject too. And on the wall is a very strange speaker.
Yes, this looks rather like a Ventaxia. It was built, I've made it in about 1928, by the TMC company. That's a telephone manufacturing company, not more than 50 yards from here as the crow flies. It's suspended from a picture hook with a terminal block at the top, and the flex supports the speaker. And it's made out of polished mahogany with a balanced armature adjustment on the front, and it goes click-clock as you move it, and has a brass cast rose on the front of it. It's a very pretty piece, really.
Now, what do you mean by a balanced armature?
Well, that's where you get a piece of metal connected to a reed, which is balanced between two magnets, and this spring-loaded adjustment holds it between the magnets to get the best sound. Otherwise, if it grounds on one of the magnets, it would sound pretty dreadful.
So you'd have to adjust this yourself?
Oh, yes, nearly every time you switch the set on, you'd have to reset it to get the best sound, and the sound was remarkably good for that period.
And how long did that design last for?
Well, until the moving coil speaker came along in about 1930.
Are there many surviving crystal sets? Because after all, you really are going back if you're talking about crystal sets.
We're not going back all that far. Actually, a lot of crystal sets were still in use in the 30s. That's mostly because of the economic climate, and people who wanted radio bad enough and hadn't got any money would make their own. Like this one here, which was called the Godfrey Phillips. The Godfrey Phillips Cigarette Company issued cigarette cards, a whole series on exactly how to make a crystal set. How to cut up all the bits of wood, how to wind the coils, shape the brass, make the cat's whisker. Every single detail. It could be made for probably under £1, I should think. And it works remarkably well. It's big and it's clumsy, but it's a fine-looking piece.
And these cigarette cards were enclosed in the cigarette packet?
Oh, yes, you'd get one card with each packet of 20, and they would send you, on request, a free album, and you'd stick them all in the album. When you got all the full amount, then you could start making your crystal set.
And how many cards were there?
I should imagine there'd have been about 50.
So it took quite a lot of cigarettes before you could actually get the instructions?
Oh, yes, absolutely, yes.
And could you actually save coupons and actually get a radio ready built?
Oh, yes, you could. The Black Cat Cigarette Company issued a set called the KB Kitten. It was made by the Colster Brands Company, and a little two-valve set and a little Bakelite box with a lift-up lid. Beautifully made little thing. And if you saved up 500 of their coupons, they'd send you one of these sets. And there's a few surviving to this day.
Very much sought after collector's items, I guess.
Very much so indeed, because they're a beautiful bit of Bakelite moulding.
Of course, some of the early AC/DC sets were quite dangerous, weren't they?
Oh, absolutely lethal. They were made by a firm called Gambrel in this country. They'd wind wire-wound resistances on hardwood. It was fine, unless you got a short circuit in the set, because the condensers they used weren't particularly brilliant, and the thing would quite nicely catch fire.
And, of course, if you took the back off, you'd get a shock because the chassis wasn't at earth potential.
Oh, no, you'd blow yourself to pieces. Yes, it's quite dangerous, yes.
You're talking earlier about the loudspeakers being hidden under strange-looking ornaments. Now, this radio seems to be very well hidden.
Oh, yes. Most of the early radios either look like bureaus, chiffoniers or something, but this one looks like a commode. It would make a very good commode, I'm sure. As you know, most of the early wireless sets were made by the motor trade. Well, this was a contribution by Metropolitan Vickers of the aero industry.
And I noticed that the valves...
They're sprung. The valves are sprung. They spring around beautifully. It's what we call anti-bong valve holders. That's because the electrode construction wasn't particularly brilliant, and if you tapped them, they made a nice bonging noise in the loudspeaker.
So this was a sort of a cushioning effect?
Oh, very much so, yes. They mounted the whole valve holder on very light springs.
But did that mean that the lifetime of the filament was a bit shorter then?
It wasn't wonderful, no, I'll agree with you, yes.
What era is that?
Oh, I'd say about 1923.
It must have got pretty hot if you sat on the top of it.
No, funnily enough, they ran remarkably cool. It wasn't until the mains valves came along that you could fry an egg on top of a set.
Now, have a listen to this.
Distinctive sound of Bert Camford on Tizzy H with Don Cushen. Last night I didn't get to sleep at all. Vicky Carr.
The sound of Australian radio station 2CH. And actually, although that recording was taken off medium wave AM, it's also in stereo. Medium wave stereo is still trying to take off at important markets like North America and the Pacific. Some doubt whether it ever will. But the concept isn't new. In Holland, just after the war, a former employee of Radio Netherlands, Professor Jan Geluk, made experiments with stereo using two medium-wave transmitters.
Yes, that is long ago. After the war, we were desolated in studio equipment at all, so we had to rebuild everything. It was first with tubes at that time, 10 years later, all these transistors, of course. And the industry was not working at all at that moment. We were just as poor as we were, so we had to do it ourselves. During the war, under the, let's say, the eyes of the German occupation, we did some work preliminary to rebuilding. We realized that, so we did it all very carefully. And one of the things I was interested in was the stereophony. Stereophony had already an first step on discs with two little mirrors, as it is called, for the left hand and the right hand channel. It was with Philips, where the Boer was working on it. And we took that up for broadcasting, and we developed an artificial head, was it called, a wooden head.
And on the on this artificial head were two microphones, presumably.
Two microphones. You can see them on the photograph from one side. Condenser microphone, also made by the laboratory at those days. Nothing was to be bought.
Now, the idea, presumably, then, of putting the microphones roughly where your ears are, is to simulate, in fact, that you were sitting there.
That was the idea. It had a great success, I must say, because we were all very interested in new developments. Of course, I know your remark, isn't it possible with one medium wave transmitter? It's not excluded, but it's very difficult, and the receiver cost is high.
Going back to your idea, I mean, if you had two medium wave transmitters, presumably the listener in the house needed two radios.
Yes. That was the necessity, and many people did it. There were some publications on the subject, because in those days people were just even friendly with their neighbours, so they could share the...
left and right.
Yeah, left and right.
How many broadcasts were made in that system? Are you talking about many or just a few experiments?
A few experiments only.
Presumably these stereo broadcasts had to be live, because you had no way of recording them.
That's
in
correct.
Stereo.
That's correct. Nothing has been recorded, so I cannot offer you a recording of that first transmission.
By 1962, attention had turned to VHF-FM as the future for stereo broadcasting in Europe, and Jan Geluk was appointed chairman of a working party to look into the technicalities of it all. Surely the aim must have been to reach one worldwide standard for FM, unlike the current battle with AM stereo in North America.
Of course, we had at that moment, even in the EBU, the European Broadcasting Union, we had about 6-7 systems. And in those days we were discussing how much would it cost to have a stereo receiver instead of a mono. And then counting the tubes was then a familiar thing. So today one can only laugh.
There's a growing number of sources of information about vintage radio in Europe, indeed further afield as well. Ken Mason Jr. lives in Washington, D.C., and he explained to me that vintage radio receivers up to 50 years old can be found in North America if you know where to look.
Yes, it is available in most medium to large-sized cities. Of course, there are antique shops. As well as yard sales, which are quite popular, yard or basement sales or backyard sales. Americans have this thing for saving things, and then, of course, the other side of that is periodically they want to rid themselves of their excess. So people will go through their attics, basements, and throughout their house and find things that they want to sell off. And many times one can find receivers, again, going back some of them 20, 30, 40 years, at reasonable prices in these sales. Of course, the conditions vary a lot according to how well they've been kept over the years.
In general, they've usually been kept, as you say, in a basement and maybe covered in mold or rust or whatever.
Yes, that's quite common to find them in that condition. Although there are people who have taken good care of their radios, they in many cases have become a display. Radios that work perfectly well have become kind of a display thing in the home, and you come to find that they do, in fact, still work.
But what about if they don't work? I mean, can you restore them? Is it very much a specialist job? And if you're not technical, can you, in fact, find people that can fix it?
You can find people that will fix it, although my experience has been that most of them are reluctant to. It's expensive. Many of the people who have the capability to fix these radios are just not interested in working on older radios. They don't find it as profitable or as interesting to them as the person who wants it repaired.
Is there a particular period that's in vogue, in fashion at the moment?
I would say that there are probably groups of people that are interested in things going by periods. The things that I tend to lean toward because of their aesthetic appeal happen to be things that are, say, from about 1940 on. And those seem to be the most popular. The parts for them and materials to be able to fix them up are still largely available, and the collection of written material that's available to research these radios is more readily available.
There are societies that you can join, too.
One of the largest and most well-known is called the Antique Wireless Association. They have their headquarters in a small town in upper New York State. They have a very fascinating museum there, which I have been to, but they mostly trade through a newsletter.
You mentioned spare parts, getting tubes or valves for sets, also to a certain extent replacing components that either dry out or just go from age. Can you get all the original parts?
In most cases, yes. Most of the parts that are likely to go bad and need some sort of repair are still generally available. There are several mail order houses that have stocked old tubes. Many of the other little wires and things, of course, it's not a problem to replace. Wire is wire and still remains so. And when you have old wires where the coating has come off or the wire has gotten brittle or something like that, it's very easy to go through and replace. It's just a matter of time-consuming. It's very time-consuming. But the other side is that many of the radios were larger, and there is room to get in with small tools or a soldering iron and do the work that is necessary.
If you'd like more details about the societies in your part of the world, then drop a line to Media Network and ask for the receiver shopping list. Finally, a letter from David Gordonson, who lives in the Netherlands, but obviously has connections with Britain. He bought himself a vintage television a few months back and wonders if it can ever be made to work again, bearing in mind that it was designed to produce a picture made up of 405 lines, not 625 that we currently use in the Netherlands. Well, Gerald Wells offers some hope.
Well, it is possible to feed a video through them and record some 405 material, or there's still 405 material available on tape, which can be put through them quite easily with suitable adaptations. And there are one or two standards converters kicking around which have been presented to us by the IBA and the BBC, so we can watch these poor old relics working very nicely on a choice of four channels.
Yeah, the definition, as far as I can see, seems to be excellent.
Well, state-of-the-art was very good in 1938. It was a bit wishy-washy in 1936, but we had viewable pictures. By 1938, a 9-inch black-and-white set gave just as good a picture as a 9-inch black-and-white set does today.
That the design of the picture tube, though, is somewhat different.
It's what we call an onion tube. It was basically a round tube, sometimes hand-blown, usually made by Pyrex, and was very, very curved, and it took quite a lot of correction circuits to get a flat picture, but they managed it. Of course, it didn't have an implosion guard. It had a plate glass thing in front of it. The cabinets were enormous. The EHT was rectified mains at something like 4,000 or 5,000 volts, and it carried about 22 valves. But for all that, it was fairly reliable.
And they certainly used a lot of power, I guess.
Oh, yes, it made the electric light meter go round like a spin dryer.
Media Network, not only the when and where, but also the why of shortwave radio.
Woody Allen, the American filmmaker, has come out with a new film with the interesting title of Radio Days. It's due to premiere here in Europe shortly, although it's been out for a couple of months already in North America. Rob Horvitz lives in Washington, D.C., has extensive radio experience, and so put on his film critic's dark overcoat and went to the movies for us. So, how did Radio Days stand up to the test?
Well, as a Woody Allen fan and a radio enthusiast, I was really looking forward to this film. it's a film which is really a nostalgia piece about what his fantasies of the life of the people who performed on radio were like in the late 40s, early 50s when he was growing up. And it wasn't hilariously funny, nor was it a deeply probing film. In fact, I felt that it was somewhat a dishonest film because the view of radio which he offers is not the way it actually was, but the way he thought it was. And as I look at the situation, I think he's really doing very little more than entrenching and exploiting the already existing mythology of that period.
What a shame, because it's a lovely title for a film.
It's a lovely era in radio, and to the extent that the Woody Allen audience did not experience it firsthand, it's good to expose them to it. But I don't think that it's an accurate reflection of what radio looked like to the performers. And it really emphasizes the entertainment aspects of radio, which are the direct antecedents of television. And there are some very funny scenes in it of a radio game show, for instance, and Mia Farrow, who plays a very interesting character, starting off as a cigarette girl and rising to fame and fortune as a radio voice. But in the end, I think it's really not one of his better films.
Is it in color? Because some of his recent films have been in black and white, deliberately.
It is. And the film that I kept thinking about in the audience while I was watching Radio Days was Stardust Memories, which is a very autobiographical film in which Woody Allen plays himself as the hard-pressed director who's asked to make funny films by his audience while he wants to make serious films. This film was really very lukewarm. It was nice, it was funny, it was warm, it was attractively photographed, but it was really very bland overall.
Next week, we're back with Media News Update. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks in Hilversum, wishing you the best of good wireless reception.
Some stations talk to the world. Radio Netherlands talks to people.
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website.
This is Media Network with Jonathan Marks,
where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network program. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.
I regret to inform you this recording is now officially over.
We would very much appreciate your comments and questions about our programming here at PCJ Radio. You can contact us via email at pcjradio@gmail.com. Once again, that's pcjmedia@gmail.com. We also invite you to visit our website, www.pcjmedia.com, and listen to all our programs. You can either download them from the website directly or subscribe to all our programs in iTunes at www.pcjmedia.com. And while you're at our website, do take part in the Happy Station Show Friendship Sponsorship Program. There are three levels: silver for $1, gold for $5, and platinum for $10. The selection is yours. This is PCJ Radio.